I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN. What is it that makes us, as humans, different? Even, shall I say, better than monkeys? Well, I mean, if Charlie Darwin was right, we both came down from the same tree. So how did we, as humans, get to where we are today and monkeys are still, well, monkeys? Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys. Well, I like to believe it's our ability to build a bigger world around us, to explore and to create, to make our world a better place through the arts and sciences. And today's guest on Better Than Monkeys is constantly striving to make the world a better and more beautiful place in so many ways. He's the Erie Philharmonic's principal second violin. He's the director of the Erie Junior Philharmonic, a music educator, luthier, and training, all-around nice guy. Today's guest on Better Than Monkeys, our good friend Jonathan Moser.
How do you sound in headphones?
It sounds pretty cool.
It's nice. Your voice is deeper in headphones.
It is. And more refined.
Joining me here live in the studio, Jonathan Moser, the principal second violin with your Erie Philharmonic. Now, he teaches music at Mercyhurst University, but today we want to talk to Jonathan in his capacity as a violinist with the Erie Philharmonic and maybe as a instructor, a teacher with the Junior Philharmonic. So on these episodes of Better Than Monkeys, what we want to do is we want to speak to the principals, the first section members of your Erie Philharmonic. These are the ones who set the parameters that all the other musicians follow when you play in a giant ensemble. You can't just have mayhem, obviously, and the conductor looks over at a violin section and expects you all to play exactly the same. So let's start right there, and then we'll go back into your career a little bit after that. But as the principal second violin, you are obviously in the first chair of the second violin section, which means that you set the tone for the second violins, correct?
Yes.
So the first violin, the concertmaster, does he set the tone for the, or she, the entire violin section? Or do you have some leeway? Do you set all the bowings? Do you set all the stylistic things for the second violins? How does that dynamic work between the concertmaster and the principal second violin?
Sure. The concertmaster actually sets the tone for the whole string section, not just the violins first and second. So that starts as early as the bowings, just getting the bowings the same way, because the way that you articulate something definitely changes the way the phrase sounds. And so the way we'll start a piece is that we'll get a copy of the music, and that copy will have Ken's bowings, whatever he...
That's Ken Johnson.
Ken Johnson, mm-hmm. Yeah, whatever he wants to do in that particular piece. And then each of the following sections, so the violas, the cellos, the second violins, even the double bass, then base their bowings off of the bowings that Ken has set. They might not all match, but we're looking to get the same ideas across. So right. If he wants something very articulated, he'll take and put separate bowings in, for example, down, up, down, up. If he wants something to have a long, drawn-out phrase, he might even do something where the outside of the section is doing one bowing and the inside of the section is doing a different bowing so that you don't hear the different breaks in the bow. It's kind of like staggered breathing in a choir.
Right.
And so we'll imitate those sorts of things and try to match what he's doing as best as possible. And through that, his artistic sense of how the piece should be realized is spread throughout the entire string section. And then it actually will go beyond that, because oftentimes the woodwinds will imitate those sorts of phrasings if they're important enough.
Right.
And then if Daniel disagrees, he'll say, you know what, I really would prefer to have a break here or something. And so then Ken will make that change, and then
everybody else follows suit.
Exactly.
So it's not mayhem. You would think it would be if you just sat down 40 string players and said, okay, play. You would see, if you were sitting in the audience, bows going everywhere.
Pretty much.
Right? So as it sits now, you sit down and you see a pretty uniform flow of bowings with this string section. So does Ken Johnson or the principal, the concertmaster, do they use historical bowings, or do they self-bow every piece of music that comes across their desk? Like, is there a collection of historically accepted bowings for major orchestral works?
Certainly. There are, I guess the way that I hear it said usually is, go listen to a recording so you know how it goes.
Right.
And you'll be better off when you come to it trying to figure it out. So yeah, there would be not only historic, but it does depend on what ensemble you're looking at as well, because Philadelphia has a sound, Cleveland has a sound, Chicago has a sound, and part of that sound is how something is bowed. So I wouldn't say he would start from scratch. Oftentimes the parts that we're getting already have at least a good basic set of bowings. And there are, I guess, general rules of thumb, that this is really going to work best if you do it this way type of thing. So it's not just from scratch. But he has other things to consider as well, because we might be getting the parts from Baltimore. We might be getting the parts from Philadelphia, and they have 16, 18, 20 violins in a section type of thing. And we only have, 10 or 12 type of thing. So the amount of bow, for example, that we have to use in order to create the same amount of sound
is more,
right? So you have to change the bowings to suit the ensemble that you're in as well.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN Radio.
So how do you get to be the principal second violin? How do you get to be a second violin in a Philharmonic orchestra? Say your career path, was it standard? You went to high school, you learned to play some violin somewhere along the lines, you ended up in college, and before you know it, you're playing in the Erie Philharmonic Orchestra. You didn't just get there.
No. Right? Yeah, so it's been a long career path for me. I'll try to keep it focused on the violin. But I started when I was five, when I was playing on violin. And my mom wanted me to start on piano, but there weren't any teachers at the time who would take a five-year-old piano student. And so she started me on violin, and I just never switched.
Right. Did you do traditional lessons, or did you do like a Suzuki method?
Yeah, I was into the Suzuki method at that point. It was fairly rare for young kids to take lessons outside of that. That was one of the features of Suzuki, starting early. And so, yes, I was Suzuki. But Suzuki is more than just a repertoire. Suzuki is really a philosophy of education, with the concept that never too young, rarely too old to twinkle. So it's the idea that any child, any person can come to at basically any field and become proficient at it with the right kind of instruction, which was a big break from the concept of, hey, you have to be this tall, you have to have this length of fingers, you have to have this background of history in order to actually make a career in it. So anyway, yes, I was brought up in the Suzuki method, but I had Suzuki teachers all the way through into my college career, and we weren't learning from the Suzuki books at that point, but the philosophy was there. So I started with lessons, continued with lessons through college, got my bachelor's and my master's degrees in performance. And at that point, I decided I was really feeling like I wanted to go a different direction. And so I left my playing behind for a while and went into church music and was really involved in choral directing, in worship creation. I would play my violin regularly there. And during that time, I actually played with the Erie Phil. I was in Pittsburgh, and I lived in Pittsburgh, and I commuted up and played with the Erie Philharmonic for 7 years. Then we moved away to Philadelphia, got too far away from Erie to commute, continued in that direction, and then life changes happened and directions altered. And so I switched and went back to kind of my first love and started performing a whole lot more again and working up my audition chops. And so you'd asked how you become a section leader. Well, I mean, the first thing is to take an audition. And I've taken a lot of auditions over my career.
Right.
And so when we had moved back to Erie, they did not have a principal second. And I took the audition, and in that audition, they accepted a certain number of people, and they offered me the position of principal second. And that's based off of a lot of things. It might not even be necessarily the most polished performer, but it's a person who has a rounded set of skills. So it's not just going to be, do you have chops, but it's going to be, do you have leadership skills? Do you have the kind of musicality that they're looking for? Do you have the kind of personality that will work well with the concertmaster and work well within the section of principals that they already had? So there's a lot of considerations that are there for a principal spot that wouldn't necessarily be there for just a section spot.
Well, you mentioned the audition process. Now, in a lot of other facets of the music world, your audition is, hey, that cat can play. Why don't we get him to come play with us? And so people in maybe the big band swing world, a lot of the jazz musicians, a lot of the rock musicians, you know somebody, they bring you in. If the rest of the band likes you, you end up in a spot. Mm-hmm. It's pretty straightforward. And if they don't like you, you don't get called back. It's pretty easy like that. So the audition process in the orchestral world can be a little daunting. You're given a set of excerpts, which is little pieces, snippets of major works to prepare, and you prepare them over and over and over until you've got them very polished, right? Mm-hmm. And then you apply to get an audition. You send in a resume or something. They go, okay, let's bring these people in. And they bring you in, and it's you.
Yes.
In a room with a bunch of people staring at you.
Well, not the first time.
Not the first time. It's behind a cardboard
screen
or a screen usually the first time. But it can be a little intimidating.
Oh, it's
And with so much anxiety and angst already as a performer, you know, you already feel the pressure of needing to be perfect, needing to have the world hear you. And then to be put in a room with people who you could end up working with and maybe people you've idolized for your entire life. It can be daunting. So how do you get into the audition process psychologically? How do you survive the audition process? And what do you take away from it should you not win an audition?
Well, the process is a very difficult process, and it is more psychological for sure, because like you mentioned, you're given these little snippets of pieces, and depending on the orchestra, you have larger or smaller snippets. But you, regardless, you have spent 4 to 6 months of your life in a practice room working on certain things, and it's likely that you'll get 5 minutes of time to showcase just hours and hours of work. And going into an audition, how do you feel? What's the weather like? Mm-hmm. How's your instrument going to treat you that day? All of these things fall into place in terms of how an audition is going to go. And then regardless of how the audition goes, is your sound the kind of sound that they're looking for? It's not even a matter of whether you're whether you play it perfectly. It's like, okay, you play it perfectly for you and you're set up and all that, but that's really not going to blend with, say, whatever. And so part of the psychological survival is taking yourself out of it, is realizing, you know, I'm going to do my best. I'm putting up forward my best. And even my best, even if it's equal to somebody else, that just might not be what they're looking for. And there are people who have taken audition after audition after audition and not progressed. You know,
right.
I've taken a lot of auditions and not made it past the first round. Even our concertmaster has taken a ton of auditions and not made.
Well, I have a very good friend who's probably one of the best players on his instrument that I know, who is the worst auditioner on the planet. Nerves kick in. And, you know, put him with 300 other people and he can play until the day is over. Put him in a room with somebody staring at you and he locks up.
Yeah.
And he gets some severe performance anxiety at that point, you know. And I'm sure that's common. And I have a master class I attended one time with a very famous trumpet player. And he came in and he'd flown all night long and he was performing for us, right? So it's 8:30 in the morning and he gets out his trumpet and he blows a few notes and he starts to play and he screws up and he stops in front of a whole room full of people, kind of shakes it off, starts again, screws up again. And he goes, well, this is a great lesson for everybody. He goes, some days you're just going to suck. And as long as you know that, you're going to be okay.
Right.
You know, which is a really valuable piece of advice, because that I've applied that to myself. Easily. Some days you're just not going to have it.
Right.
But when you go to an audition, you've probably put a lot of money into this. You've probably paid for some airfare, probably a hotel room, not to mention lessons. Maybe even if you're a pro, you might take lessons going into an audition process just to make sure that you're not missing anything important. So there's a lot invested in every audition. Do you go into them with the, I'm going to get this job as an attitude, or do you go with them, this will be great if I get this job. If not, I'm going to learn a lot having done this audition process?
I think there's aspects of both to it, because you have to have a determined, goal-oriented, all-in approach to the audition in order to do your best. But there has to be also that realization that even if it doesn't work out that way, that yes, I'm going to have learned a lot. It is expensive, and it does take a lot of commitment in order to do a lot of auditions. And you do find people who have grown bitter over the years just because of how hard that can be. But, you know, there are stories on both sides. There's stories of people who have gone to auditions and the audition result was already known before they ever started. And so it really felt futile. But then there's also ones where there's a story similar to yours of the former concertmaster of Cleveland Orchestra who went, and one of the solos they were asking for, he botched. Mm-hmm. At least twice. And they kept asking, you want to do that again or something? And finally he said, they asked, you know, do you want to do it again? He says, well, not today.
Yeah.
and he still won the position. So, because it was clear that this was just one of those days type of thing.
It happens, you know, yeah. One of those day things. The other thing to remember is, you know, especially in the trumpet world, I'm a trumpet player, the excerpts that they pick are the same excerpts over and over. And I know why they do that. They obviously do it for a reason. They want to hear your musicality. They want to hear your technique. They want to hear your sound. But I've also got some friends who've won auditions and in their entire career have played one piece that was excerpted in their audition.
Right.
You know, so there is a lot invested. It's like preventative maintenance on your car. You know, you have to change your oil. You have to change your tires to make sure your car runs right. I think it's kind of the same with an audition process. You know, you might not really use the audition material again in the way that you've prepared it.
Right.
Because it's going to change from the time you're alone in a practice room till you're sitting in an ensemble with 20 other violins.
Oh, absolutely. You'll never play it that way.
Right.
Ever. You would never play in an orchestra the way that you play in an audition.
Right.
Because it's just you. And, you know, you ask for a piano and, well, okay, that's a piano, but you're standing on Carnegie Hall. You need to make a piano that's going to be heard by the people, you know,
right.
40 rows back or whatever. But if you're in a section of 20 violins and you play the piano that you played in your audition, you're going to be yelled at. Oh, yeah.
Well, you don't just play the violin. You
I
teach.
Don't.
You also started a little bit of career learning to be a luthier a bit. Music isn't really just as focused as everybody thinks it is. You know, the principal trumpet in many major orchestras also teaches. So, you know, there's things that go along with your career of being a professional musician that maybe you don't see when you're in college. You know, you get the grandiose vision of wanting to be a performer on a world stage. But then there's the reality of making a living mm-hmm. and supporting your art and supporting your organizations. So you teach at Mercer University
yes.
in the string studio there. You also work with the Junior Philharmonic. As the director of the Junior Philharmonic, and you've started to become a luthier.
Yeah.
So why don't you give us a little background into all your side businesses, your side hustles. We'll call them your side hustles.
There you go. Well, I think that at one point in, you know, for a long time in music, you could be focused. I think before you had the professional symphony, that musicians were very diverse. And I think now, as we're coming into a new period of time, that musicians are also needing to be diverse. You know, you have an audition and there's one, two positions available and you have 150, 200 people auditioning for it. Well, what happens to all those people who don't necessarily get that position?
We're all probably very good.
Exactly. So the idea of diversity is very important in our field. And as I earlier mentioned, I started in performance, and that was my career, that was my goal. But at the end of that, I went into church music. I was interested in something else. While I was in church music, I dabbled in a ton of things. I played some bluegrass music. I was almost a part of a mariachi band when we lived in El Paso. Imagine me in a sombrero. Huh?
That'd have been fun.
Yeah. I toured for 2 years with an Indian tabla player, and we did a lot of house concerts and the Detroit Concert of Colors and, you know, things like that. So, you know, being diverse and having a broad palette, you know, is, I think, very important. And so, yes, I teach. My expertise lies in students that are a little more advanced than the beginners. I'm not particularly trained at early childhood education.
Right. Fortunately, you know some people who are.
I do. And so that's one of the areas that I enjoy. I also discovered through church music, discovered my love of conducting, and had various opportunities to conduct choral ensembles, and then was able to branch out from there to orchestral ensembles, and have really enjoyed that. And so being able to merge both the love of being in charge and being able to work with kids. Yeah, it's interesting in my role is if I'm principal, second, if I'm concertmaster, if I'm conductor, I definitely exude a different kind of personality because at that point, somebody needs to make decisions, and I have very strong ideas of how I would like things to go. So usually in life, I'm pretty laid back.
Right. But put you on a podium with a baton in your hand.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. Exactly.
Well, Jonathan did just say he has some pretty strong ideas, so we're going to have him back again for the next episode of Better Than Monkeys. Let him share some of those strong ideas with you. I hope you're enjoying this episode of Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN Radio. If you're enjoying BTM, well, you can find more episodes. Episodes featuring Judy Collins, Cheetah Rivera, Joanne Folletta, Mark Russell. You can find them at wqln.org/BTM, and you can listen to the episodes on SoundCloud and NPR One. And if you visit the WQLN website, check out all of the radio and television quality programming that WQLN offers. You can even check out some of WQLN's special activities, like our road trips. And you'll also find information on one of our newest offerings, a 24/7 children's channel featuring safe children's programming. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN.